Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's so good to see you today. Welcome to the Third Court of Appeals. Everyone, we have only one case for oral argument this morning. And as you know, this matter is being recorded and shown live via YouTube. This hearing is being conducted in accordance with the emergency orders of the Texas Supreme Court considering the COVID-19 pandemic. If you're not speaking this morning, I'm going to ask that you mute yourselves just so that we can keep background noise to a minimum, trying to avoid dog barking power washing or leaf blowing. That seems to be the thing of the day in COVID pandemic world and remote hearings. Your videos, counsels, will be continuously shown to the public, whether you're speaking or not. Also, the chat function is not available for this hearing. So if you have any technical difficulties, I think that you have been provided with the cell phone numbers of my court staff. Please feel free to text them if you're having technical difficulties, and we'll try to pause the proceeding as we get those technical difficulties worked out, and then continue proceeding. The video broadcast of this proceeding is only available now. Live, it will not be available on the court's website. However, this audio recording will be made available on the court's website probably this afternoon. At this point, I'd like to call for ready announcements from the attorneys in this morning's case, which is case number CV20428, Employees Retirement System of Texas versus Judge Martin Lowy. Counsels, please introduce yourself and announce ready. We'll start with the appellants.
Charles Eldred for Appellant, Employees Retirement System of Texas.
Thank you. And the appellees? And Ms. Riggs, you're on mute.
Jennifer Riggs here for Judge Lowy, and we are definitely ready to proceed.
Thank you very much. And for those of you who are new to the Third Court, each side is allocated 20 minutes to argue. Mr. Jeff Kyle, the court clerk, has already coordinated with the attorneys on the time allotments desired for this proceeding. As you know, we generally reserve time at the end for the appellant's rebuttal so that they have the last word. In this case, Employees Retirement System of Texas will have 15 minutes to open their argument in this case, and then Judge Lowy will have his 20 minutes to argue, followed by 5 minutes rebuttal by the Employees Retirement System of Texas. We have a time warning system to assist the attorneys in knowing when their time is up. When the yellow light comes on, the attorneys have 2 minutes to wrap up that segment of their argument. When the red light comes on, the lawyer's time is up and they do need to wrap up. However, if they're in the middle of an argument, the court typically allows them to conclude that particular argument to close out their thoughts. The attorneys may also be provided with additional time by the court at the court's discretion. And with that stated, we're going to start with Mr. Eldridge for the retirement system. And Mr. Eldridge, before you begin, I'm going to go ahead and lay out something that I've been struggling with in reading both sides' arguments in this case. And I don't want to take up your time with my question. So I'm just going to lay it out there. You don't have to address it right at the beginning, but I do want you to address it in the proceeding. You know, a lot of this argument between both sides is whether the statute is ambiguous or unambiguous. And, you know, I've got two smart lawyers in this case, and I struggle when I've got two smart lawyers that are construing the statute differently. How is it that I, as a jurist, can say it's unambiguous? isn't it by definition ambiguous? Because again, I've got two smart sides saying it reads differently. And so trying to get a handle on that during this matter. And of course, I've read your arguments, but I'd like for you to put a fine point on that for me. And you may proceed, sir. Thank you.
Well, may it please the court. The court should reverse the ruling of the trial court and render judgment in the ERS's favor, because Judge Lowy did not currently hold judicial office on January 31st, 2017. And this very question was already decided in the ERS's favor by the Supreme Court of Texas in the Werlein case in 1970, where the court ruled, and I'm going to quote them, a retired judge assigned to active duty is authorized to exercise the powers of an office while serving on assignment. He does not, by virtue of the assignment, however, hold an office that could potentially become vacant. So the Werlein case distinguishes between holding office and being a visiting judge. And there was a dissent in Werlein where the dissenter said, visiting judges are judicial officers, therefore they must be judicial office holders. And that's also the argument that that Judge Lowy makes in this case, but that has already been determined against that argument by the Supreme Court of Texas in binding precedent. And the distinction also exists in Article 5, Section 186 of the Texas Constitution, subsection A, where the provision allows sanctions against judges who hold office, and subsection C of the same provision allows sanctions against a retired or former judge who continues as a judicial officer subject to assignment. So the categories are different. A judicial officer subject to assignment, which is what Judge Lowy was at the time he tried to retire, does not hold office under the Texas Constitution as a matter of constitutional law. And furthermore, that same provision has two different penalties or two different possible sanctions for judges. One sanction is holding judicial office in the future. Another possible sanction is sitting on a court of the state by assignment. So again, holding judicial office versus sitting on a court of the state by assignment are two different categories as a matter of constitutional law. And that decides the case in our favor. And I'm going to get to your question, Chief Justice Byrne. The statute is unambiguous, and hold judicial office is different than sitting on a court by assignment as a visiting judge. Therefore, judges who are visiting judges may not retire under Section 839.101A1 because they do not currently hold judicial office at the time while they're being a visiting judge. An office is something that's filled by one person at a time, and that continues when the office holder leaves the office. Visiting judge is not an office. Judge Lowy was a visiting judge on January 31st, 2017, and so he did not currently hold judicial office on that date, and so he cannot retire on that date under 839.101A1. Judges may retire under A1 if they do so on the day while they're on the bench. He didn't hold an office. He wasn't on the bench on that day, so he could not retire under that section. This is also confirmed by several statutes. The definition of active judge is a current judicial office holder. That's in 74.0414 of the Government Code. And a former judge means a person who has served as an active judge in a district, statutory probate, statutory county, or appellate court, but is not a retired judge. And the phrase current judicial office holder did not appear in the definition of a former judge, which is what Judge Lowy was. So a former judge, again, is not a current judicial office holder. These are different categories. Section 839.102B2 explicitly distinguishes between these categories as well. Distinguishes between a judge who at the time of retirement, either one, has not been out of judicial office for more than 1 year, or two, has served as a visiting judge in this state, and the first anniversary or the last day of that service has not occurred. The point is, the statute itself treats judges who hold office differently than a judge who has served as a visiting judge. And this is just another way this is all confirmed. Judge Lowy's main textual argument, other than the judicial officer argument, which has already been rejected by the Supreme Court, it relates to Section 838.101A. I'm going to read that one. It says, membership service is credited in the retirement system for each month in which a member holds a judicial office for which the member makes the required contribution. And Judge Lowry, I think, argues that he was earning credit while a visiting judge, so he must have been earning credit under 838.101A, and therefore he must have been holding office during that time. That's just wrong, though. He was not holding office for the reasons we said so before. And furthermore, visiting judges earn credit under Section 74.061B of the Government Code. The Attorney General had an opinion in 1977 that said, actually, I should quote that statute. It 74061D says that judges subject to assignment can earn salary, compensation, and expenses. And the Attorney General had an opinion in 1977 saying that compensation can be construed to include retirement benefits. And that's how the ARS has interpreted that since then. So the weight of constitutional and statutory provisions support ARS's reading of this unambiguous statute. Now, actually, getting into your question, Chief Justice, both parties agree the statute's unambiguous. We just disagree about what it says. Judge Lowry says that he holds judicial office just because he was on that date, January 31st, 2017, because he was on a list of judges subject to assignment. And for the reasons we've talked about, that does not hold office. That's not an office that can become vacant, that continues after someone leaves the office, such as Chief Justice of the Third Court of Appeals. When you unfortunately leave your office, someone else will hold that office.
Counselor, can I interrupt you real quick?
Yes, sir.
What about the argument that to rule in your favor, we'd be adding language to the statute that currently elected or appointed to hold judicial office? What do you say, kind of what's your response to that?
That's not adding language, that's just what holds judicial office means for the various reasons you said before. An active judge holds judicial office, and active judges, I think, have always been elected or appointed. I have to think that through if there's any other type of active judge. So we just think it's already in the statute. We're not adding words to the statute. That's just inherent in the meaning of holds judicial office.
So your position then is that language then is just the definition of what hold means?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Couldn't it have been a whole lot easier had the ledge just said active judge? And use the same language from prior statutes?
Well, active judge, again, is defined as a current judicial office holder. So the wording is not the same, but the definition is the same. Currently holds judicial office is the language of 839.101A1. Active judge is a current judicial office holder. And visiting judges, again, are judicial officers. That's different than office holder. Like, I'm an officer of the court, but I don't hold an office. A police officer is an officer, but does not hold an office. So just because you're an officer does not mean you hold an office. And again, the Wehrlein Court's already ruled on that. Chief Justice, the fact that two smart lawyers or not so smart lawyers or whatever kind of lawyers can have two different arguments about what a term means does not mean it's not ambiguous. Does not mean the term is ambiguous. You have to look at the text and the context and the canons of construction if you need to, but there is one meaning, work through it and figure out what the meaning is. This case, we don't think there's a lot of work to do because holds judicial office, especially in line with the Wehrlein case and the Constitution provision, is plainly defined as an active judge and not a visiting judge, more to the point. Judge Lowry did not hold judicial office on January 31st, 2017, so he could not retire under 839.101A1 because to retire under that section, you have to currently hold the judicial office. He was allowed to retire under A2, which says you may retire regardless of whether you hold an office. You know, the party spent a lot of time also kind of in the alternative talking about maybe the statute is ambiguous, and if it is ambiguous, did ERS construe it properly, and did they construe it in conformance with the Administrative Procedure Act? And I think I hope it came through in our briefs. We don't think you need to even think about those type of arguments if you think the statute is unambiguous, which we think it plainly is. I'd be happy to talk about the other side of the argument too. But I'll just say this, if you do think that the statute is ambiguous, and you also think that ERS violated the Administrative Procedure Act, of course, we disagree with both of those. But if you do, the proper ruling is to reverse the trial court and remand the case to ERS without instructions. I don't know if I need to talk about all that. And really, unless the court has any questions, I'm done with my presentation.
Let me just defer to my fellow justices. Are there any further questions of Mr. Eldridge? And you're on mute, Justice Baker.
I couldn't hear him.
Sorry, I was having trouble with my unmuting. I'm a dinosaur. I was just trying to confirm that the relief you're seeking here is reverse and render a decision from the court, correct?
Yes.
Yes, Justice Baker, because we feel
not, that it's not seeking remand, in other words. Apologize for talking over you.
Okay. We think the statute's unambiguous. There's undisputed facts which were established at the hearing, and no side questions whether those facts were established incorrectly or not. Those facts being that Judge Lally was 65 years old, he had 8 years of active service, 2 years of service as a visiting judge. And so we think those undisputed facts just apply to an unambiguous statute, and you can render judgment, hopefully in our favor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I guess I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
No more questions.
Thank you very much. And now, Ms. Riggs, for Judge, is it Lowy or Lowry?
Lowry.
Lowry, yes, thank you.
Yes, it's like Pete Lowry, but without the R.
So. Okay, that helps me a lot. Thank you very much, Ms. Riggs. And again, just as I did with Mr. Eldridge, I like to put a question to you at the very beginning so I don't eat into your time. Obviously, I'd love to hear your spin on what I asked Mr. Eldridge about the ambiguous versus unambiguous. But primarily for you, Ms. Riggs, your client, the judge, and in your briefing, talk about a longstanding policy of construction by the ERS. I'm trying to make sure I understand specifically what you mean in that regard. Is it that you mean that that longstanding policy is evidenced by the employees that talked to him prior to his retirement about? Is that the policy, or is there some written policy? Is there some prior decision by ERS that established the longstanding policy that you claim aligns with your client's position? And then you say there's now a new policy. So what establishes that new policy? Is it in writing? Is it because they've made this decision? And with that, I tender the floor to you, ma'am.
Thank you. And I'm happy to start with that. Our argument is not that there is any written new policy or old policy. We refuted the fact that the ERS tried to raise the existence of a longstanding policy to support its position. We refuted that. We objected to their evidence of that. There's no evidence in the record of that. And they can't enforce that unless they pass it as a rule. So we objected to that. We also said that the two ERS employees whose undisputed testimony was that Judge Lally certainly did have service credit necessary for retirement with his 8 years of elected office holding and his 2 years of assigned office holding. We believe that refutes the ERS's argument that there was some longstanding policy to the contrary. But we're not trying to argue that there is a published rule or anything else out there to that effect. And it does matter because of your other question. Why does it matter whether the statute is deemed to be ambiguous or not? We actually briefed this on page 12 of our brief, and the Supreme Court provided a partial answer in the Thompson versus Texas Department of Licensing and Regulation case. And the court at page 571 said, just because an undefined statutory term may have multiple common meanings doesn't make the statute ambiguous. The courts apply the common meaning most consistent with the context of the statutory scheme. Why does it matter? It matters because if a term is ambiguous, the courts tend to and are instructed to defer to an agency's interpretation. We don't think it is ambiguous. We think it is the kind of term that is uniquely within the court's province to decide. And we distinguish there between terms like holds judicial office and terms like extreme risk. In the Garcia versus ERS case, the term that the court deferred to the ERS on was a term that is the kind of term that an insurance carrier, and in this instance, the public equivalent of an insurance carrier, they're in the business of determining risk. So determining what would be an extreme risk experienced by an employee was more within their wheelhouse. The term holds judicial office, I would say, is more within the trial court's bailiwick and within this court's bailiwick. But it does matter because it relates to the standard of review that the court will apply. And to answer Justice Baker's question, I misunderstood. I didn't mean to jump in there. You'd asked what relief was being requested. We are not asking for remand. We're asking for reverse and render, of course, as Mr. Eldred said, in our favor, not in the ERS's favor. But we also think remand would be inappropriate because it would give the ERS a chance to bolster the administrative record. I mean, we believe that there's a very simple way to resolve this. You interpret the term holds judicial office or currently holds judicial office in the context of the JRS 2 statutes. Now those statutes include chapters 836 through 840 of the Texas Government Code. Those all establish and govern JRS, Judicial Retirement System of Texas Plan 2. Many of the things that the ERS has asked you to look at, the Texas Constitution as interpreted by the Whirling case, chapter 74 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code for your ability to object to an assigned judge, they draw those terms from other statutes. And we believe it is very important that the terms be interpreted in the context of the JRS 2 system. And there, it is undisputed that the ERS has given Judge Lowey service credit towards retirement under 838.101, which uses the same term as 839.101. So it's our position that the simplest interpretation is the one that requires the least struggling or efforts to reach out to other statutes or to the Texas Constitution.
And Justice Ms. Riggs, may I interrupt? And this is a point that Mr. Eldridge made about, so you were saying the retirement credits come from 838. He's saying they come from Chapter 74. Why do you say that's different?
Retirement service credit, Chapter 74 deals with when you can, primarily deals with when you can object to a visiting or assigned judge. Chapter 838.101 directly governs how a judge earns service credit. Now, the ERS says Chapter 838.101 and 839.101 are totally different, but they're not. 839.101 refers to service credit. And in fact, if you look at 839.101A with A1, which is the provision that Judge Lowey applied for his benefits under, it requires that the judge be at least 65 years old, currently holds a judicial office, and has at least 10 years of service credited in the retirement system. So the ERS comes back and says, yeah, we don't dispute that we gave him service credit for 10 years, but gee, that's different. Somehow that's different. You don't read 838.101 in harmony with 839.101. We simply disagree. We think those two sections are the two primary sections that should be read together. Likewise, the Werlin case dealt with the mandatory retirement at age 75. That case didn't just say an assigned judge does not hold judicial office. What Werlin said was an assigned judge, and I use assigned as opposed to visiting because they are assigned through the court procedure and pursuant to the provisions created under the Texas Constitution. But the gist of the must retire from under at age 75 is must retire from an office, a judicial office that may be vacated. Now, in the context of the Texas Constitution, that's a very different issue. Vacating a judicial office is a term of art that deals with elected offices. And that gets back to Justice Smith's question. We think the ERS is trying to read in to this statute the terms elected or appointed. And it's very clear that the Texas legislature knows how to use those qualifications when they must. And it would have been helpful. It's always helpful if the legislature gives us more information rather than less. But here, when you look at it in the context of chapters 838 and 839 of the Government Code, it is currently holds judicial office. That matters. And the constitutional prohibition is holds a judicial office that may be vacated. And I believe the court actually makes that fairly clear in the court's opinion. It is helpful, but I think the context there is that they that holds judicial office there clearly did mean an elected office, which is an office that can be vacated. There are two really simple that this court could decide this case based just on the statute. What does 839.101 mean? But there are also significant procedural issues here. And Justice Carroll, presiding over the trial court, ruled that there were procedural errors as well. And those go to the heart of what an agency must do. In essence, the parties by agreement tried this case on cross motions for summary judgment. Judge Lowy had originally asked for evidence in discovery for, let's see what your other cases are. Take out the judges' names, but let's see what your actual practice has been. The ERS wouldn't give us that information, but because we went forward on cross motions for summary judgment, we were deprived of the opportunity to pursue evidence of what their actual practice might in fact have been and why those two employees basically said, certainly you're entitled to retire with 10 years. And yes, you may combine your 8 years of elected office holding with your 2 years of assigned office holding.
Ms. Riggs, may I interrupt here? And I know you've only got 9 minutes. We're on the procedural end. It's my understanding that this argument only applies if we're going to the issue of this is an ambiguous statute. Because if you win on it's unambiguous, we don't even get here. So we are now in the world of analyzing this case as if it were ambiguous. And I know that y'all don't think that it is. I get that. But if it is ambiguous, and if we do find procedural errors that you're talking about now, and I'm sure you're going to continue to talk about, doesn't that result in the remedy that you don't want, which is a reverse and remand without instruction to the agency, allowing them to bolster their record?
No, and here's why. The rules govern cross motions for summary disposition. You don't get a second bite at the apple just because you go, oh my goodness, I would have added additional evidence here, but we didn't. Because what the ERS didn't add was any evidence about the actuarial soundness of the JRS2 system. And given that it's some $4 billion in assets, we have a difficult time determining or conceiving of the fact that $160,000 would destroy the JRS2 system. They don't have any evidence of just how many judges might be in this position. What kind of effect would it have? They never brought forth that evidence. And yet it's very clear from the findings of fact and conclusions of law that they based it on that theory. They based it on their interpretation of the statute. They also based it on, well, we have to protect the JRS2 system. And in order to protect the JRS2 system, we have to say assigned judges cannot rely on subsection 839.101A1. Now, that gets back to Justice Smith's question. That's legislating. Those arguments might well be good arguments, but that's something that the legislature should address, not the ERS. And if they were going to address it, they should have brought forth summary judgment evidence of that argument. And they don't get to go back and have a second bite at the apple, having failed to do so. We objected to their efforts to do it. They filed exceptions to the proposal for decision, arguing that they should be able to raise this argument after the cross motions for summary judgment, and they didn't do it. And so, in fact, it could be that there is a possibility that this case could be resolved on very, very narrow grounds. ERS, you may have some argument, but you didn't prove it here, because they didn't. And it's just as if parties have brought forth cross motions for summary judgment in the trial court and taken them to this court. If the court were to find a fact question, then it would be appropriate to remand it back to the trial court, saying it was improper to grant summary disposition. But in this case, the ALJ found that the ERS had not prevailed in its argument and that its legal conclusion was wrong. So there are really two grounds for that decision. There are two grounds for the trial court's decision, which are, I disagree with the ERS, Judge Carroll said, I disagree with the ERS position on the statute, and they committed procedural errors. The ERS does have authority to disagree with an administrative law judge, but as the Flores case said and the Longmire case said, the ERS has to give reasons for it, and the ERS cannot just bolster its arguments by adding new arguments after the close of evidence and by referring to evidence that is nowhere in the administrative record. And so that might actually be a narrower position upon which to base a decision in this case. We believe the procedural defects go quite a bit more extensively than that, but I would rather address the court's concerns about any of the particular ones or talk more about the statutory interpretation issues. Given that there's limited time available, I would rather answer the court's questions than delve into something that, as you indicated, Chief Justice Byrne, might not be dispositive. And with that, if there aren't questions, I will be very glad to give the court back some time. And would, without questions, would yield to the ERS. But we are asking for reversal, and or we are asking that the trial court's decision reversing the ERS decision be affirmed.
Thank you. And Justices Baker and Smith, do you have any questions of Ms. Riggs?
This could be to either counsel. Is legislative history of any value in this case on either side of the issue?
And I'll allow Ms. Riggs to answer that since she's got more time on the clock, and then if Mr. Eldridge wishes to in his rebuttal. Ms. Riggs.
Unfortunately, we did not find a great deal of assistance from legislative history, nor are the Attorney General opinions truly helpful. I think it was one of the first Attorney General opinions that indicated that our position was correct. And then there was a second one that indicated, suggested that the ERS position might be correct. So the AG opinions were not directly on point. The legislative history simply described what the statutes do. They were, however, helpful in the sense that the idea here was to make sure that judges who remain available for assignment are rewarded because of the significance and importance of having assigned judges available to the courts. And I realized I did not mention one issue that may not be directly responsive, but we're not arguing that simply being eligible for assignment or being on a list for assignment will qualify. Our argument is that Judge Lowe, in fact, served every month of those additional years, and that because he did, ERS gave him service credit, and that the service credit is what entitles him to qualify under 839.101A1.
Thank you.
Seeing nothing else, Ms. Riggs, thank you very much. And thank you for providing the court back with a little bit of time. Mr. Eldridge, now the floor is yours for rebuttal, sir.
Thank you. I do agree with Ms. Riggs. The term currently holds judicial office is the type of term that is construed by judges and not by agencies. It's not like extreme risk, which has some policy determination built into it. Currently holds judicial office has a specific meaning. We argue about what that meaning is, but for reasons I've said before, does not include visiting judges. They do not currently hold judicial office. She also talked about that you should interpret that statute that comes up with the least struggle, I think is the way she put it. We struggle to interpret our way, because our way is consistent with the Constitution, consistent with statutes, consistent with Attorney General opinions from the 70s that ERS has relied upon since the 70s to do their actuarial math on the JRS too. Judge Lowey's interpretation, again, boils down to kind of a working backwards from 838.101. And the problem with that argument is that 838.101 does not apply to visiting judges. 74061D does. And I haven't heard an argument to the contrary about that. That's been the case since at least 1977. And to get to Justice Baker's question about legislative history, I agree with Ms. Riggs, there's not a whole lot, but there is the Attorney General opinions from the 70s that both sides cited. I don't know what opinion she's talking about where she says the Attorney General supposedly at one point ruled in her favor. I don't believe that's correct. I believe the Attorney General opinions are all consistent with what we're telling you today, that visiting judges do not currently hold judicial office and therefore cannot retire under what we now know is 839.101A1. This is a small point, I think, but she said that two employees told Judge Lowey something. One of the employees actually changed his mind a few months later. So it's not like two employees, it's not undisputed. It is disputed. And also our letter to him is our official statement. The letter we wrote in March of 2017 says, you may not retire under 839.101A1 because you do not currently hold judicial office. And the letter said we've interpreted that way since 1981. And it says 81 because that's when these statutes were codified. One other small point, it's not entirely correct to say that ERS did not give any information about other judges who might be in Judge Lowey's position. Judge Lowey attached Exhibit 7 to his motion for summary disposition. It's on page 359 and 360 of the third volume of the reporter's record. And it's a ERS's discovery response to a question, produce all documents reflecting the granting of a payment or a service retirement annuity to a former judge with at least 10 years but less than 12 years of service. In other words, like Judge Lowey's experience situation. And the response was objection, but then the subject to the objection, no responsive documents can be found. So I think the record already reflects that there was no other judge that in Judge Lowey's situation that was allowed to retire in his situation. where he is a visiting judge but does not yet have 12 years experience, has between 10 and 12 years experience. So that is in the record somewhat. It's in an exhibit that Judge Lowy submitted. I guess finally, I don't think if we want to talk about what should happen if the statute is ambiguous, whether there's a trumpet siren or not, and whether there's
I think that's downtown. We're getting a siren downtown. Yes.
Sorry about that. What she's saying is that the ERS committed procedural errors, and of course we disagree. But if they did commit procedural errors, the correct and if the statute is ambiguous such that the procedural errors matter, then the remedy is reverse the trial judge and remand to ERS. You can call it a second bite at the apple if you'd like. That's just what the statute says. If they've committed procedural errors, this court is not authorized to rule in Judge Lowy's favor. It's only authorized to send the case back to ERS and try again. So for all these reasons, the ERS requests the court reverse the trial court's ruling and render judgment in ERS's favor that Judge Lowy is not entitled to retire on January 31st, 2017 under Section 839.101(a)(1).
Thank you, counsels. This case is and will be submitted today, and this court stands in recess. Thank you very much for this diligent presentation, an interesting presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Have a good day.
Thank you.